I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Dave Davies in for Marty Moss-Cohen. While much of the world's attention lately has focused on Iran's nuclear program, less noticed are troubling signs of a return to religious fanaticism and accompanying restrictions on social, political, and intellectual life in the country. There are small things, like the concert in which women members of the orchestra had to sit behind a black curtain for the performance, and much larger ones, the closing of newspapers, the removal of secular university professors, and in June the sentencing of a 34-year-old mother of two to death by stoning after she was convicted of adultery. This morning on Radio Times, we're going to talk about the growing influence of militant Islam on life in Iran with a woman who knows the story firsthand. Azar Nafisi began her work in education as a teacher of literature in Iran before being expelled from the University of Tehran in 1981 for refusing to wear the mandatory Islamic veil. She returned to teaching in 1987, but resigned her university position in the mid-1990s to protest increasing restrictions on women students. Her best-selling memoir, Reading Lolita in Tehran, is about the 2 years she continued to teach in secret, meeting with students weekly in her home, where they read a range of novels. Dr. Nafisi has written many other books, including an academic work on Vladimir Nabokov's novels, which was published in Tehran in 1994, and she's currently working on two books, one about the lives of women in Iran at the end of the 19th century and another on the power of imagination. She is currently a visiting fellow and lecturer at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced Intellectual Studies. Azar Nafisi, welcome back to Radio Times.
It's great to be back. Thank you.
It's good to have you. I know that you were on the show when your novel was published. We want to invite our listeners to give us a call. The number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Well, Azar Nafisi, you know, Time magazine, in a piece last month, called What's Happening in Iran, the Steady Creep Towards Talibanism. But Iran is, of course, very, very different from Afghanistan. I thought you could begin by giving us a sense of the Iranian middle class. It's, you know, this is a country of, what, 68 million people. What's the relative size of the middle class?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I don't think those terms are helpful if they do not apply to the specific situation in Iran. Iran, since early 20th century, has been moving towards creating democratic or institutions. And there has been a fight for it in 1906. The Constitutional Revolution created a very progressive constitution based on the Belgium Constitution. And ever since then, the country has been moving more and more towards modernization. So the middle class, despite the fact that it had been weakened by the assaults on both the institutions and this specific class in particular by the Islamic Revolution, is still very strong. And you see its marks, especially in the area of culture and in the kind of resistance that comes out of the society towards the government.
Now, when was the last time you were in the country?
Well, I left Tehran, actually, elected president, which was 1997.
I'm sorry, we had a weak line. Can you just say that again? You left the country in 1997?
I left Iran right after Mr. Khatami was elected president, which is in 1997.
Okay. And are you in regular communication with people in Iran, and does that remain easy and possible?
Yes, I'm very much in touch, both through email and phone calls, but also through people who regularly visit this country, former students, former colleagues, as well as good friends. And you know, if you go on the internet, despite the repression, you see that the Persian bloggers are very, very active. Iran is not a closed country, despite the efforts by the Islamic government.
Well, you know, that was one of many things I wanted your thoughts on as we talk about some of the new restrictions that the Iranian government is putting on social, political, and intellectual life there. Are they going after bloggers too?
They're going after everyone. Actually, if you remember, it was last year when they arrested some of these young bloggers who were tortured, and some of them were forced to come on TV to confess to their sins, and they were accused of, you know, usually people are accused of working for foreign powers, but the government is very, very sensitive towards this form of communication. But it is very difficult. If you have a vibrant civil society, it is impossible to stop all of them. And I think this is the problem that the government is facing today.
Let's talk about some of the steps that have been undertaken over the past year. One thing that's been described is government trucks rolling down streets with satellite dishes piled in dump trunks. What's going on there?
Well, you know, this ever since, I mean, when satellite dishes became prevalent in Iran, which goes back to especially early 90s, and I remember that we had this cat and mouse game with the government where people would buy the forbidden dishes, and of course there were rumors that in fact some of the members of the Revolutionary Guards and militia were active in selling them underground. Otherwise, it was impossible to have so much access to satellite dishes. And in the poorer areas of Tehran, for example, one family would have a satellite dish and they would sell tickets to favorite shows to others. And then they started banning them, putting a fine of up to 1 year jail sentence, monetary fines. Sometimes they were accompanied by flogging and, you know, stricter sentences. But it hasn't worked. It hasn't worked. And that is one thing that sometimes maybe the media here forget, the fact that the Iranian regime for the past 27 years has been using any means possible to ban certain things from the Iranian society, and it has failed. And this is, again, another failed effort.
So when you say it has failed, I mean, clearly it has affected the lives of many lives and careers of people, you know, in universities such as yourself.
You're definitely right. It is sometimes difficult to present to people the paradoxical and contradictory picture that comes out of Iran, because one side of it is, as you mentioned, lives have been lost, as well as careers, and a lot of pain has been inflicted upon different strata of society and individuals. One thing that has that gives me a flicker of hope is the fact that none of the strict punishments it imposed upon society, whether it was in regards to women's mandatory veils or forbidden satellite dishes, forbidden videos, forbidding culture in essence, and knowledge in universities, instead of forcing people to conform, it has in fact encouraged many of the people who at the beginning of the revolution were Islamist to now come to the other side. And as you know, Iran has about 70% of Iran's population is under the age 30. And I think this young generation who has been flogged and jailed for wearing lipstick or for listening to forbidden music is much more hardy than my generation. And I don't think that they're going to give up the fight in this around these issues.
We're speaking with Azar Nafisi. She is a former professor in Tehran. She now lives in the United States, and she is the author of the best-selling memoir, Reading Lolita in Tehran. Well, you've described a situation in which a lot of particularly younger Iranians are effectively resisting some of the government efforts to control their lives. You know, I'm wondering if we have a misimpression from news accounts over the past week, which really paints a picture of an increased wave of repression. I mean, like things like, I mean, there was an anecdote given of a cafe owner where women would come and enjoy themselves, and then recently the cafe owner was told women will not be permitted to smoke in public, and so that isn't happening. And then much more serious things, such as President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad indicating that secular university professors ought to be dismissed. Is this happening? Are we seeing?
Yes. This is all happening and more. In fact, I'm glad that you're bringing this up because I think we need to give people in Iran as much voice as possible. The workers at the beginning of Mr. Ahmadinejad's term presidency, the transportation workers went on strike. They were asking for very, very basic monetary needs. And 750 of workers, their families, including children, were arrested. Some of them were tortured. Some of them are still in jail. And they were very harshly put down. Since March 8, Iranian women have staged two demonstrations. In the first one, the 80-year-old Iranian feminist poet Simine Behbahani herself participated, and they were harassed, they were beaten, and they were supposed to be dispersed. So all of this is happening, and that actually gives the lie to people who kept thinking that this regime can change and it can be reformed, it goes through waves of liberalization and then waves of repression. One thing that I think the media does not pay much attention to is the resistance to this. And the fact that this has been the situation more or less for the past 27 years, I think that the media has been turning Mr. Ahmadinejad into some kind of George Clooney of the bad guys.
Talking about his sort of suave intellectual kind of style?
Yeah, from Anderson Cooper to Mike Wallace, some of our best people not asking him the most crucial questions. Not a single one of them asked about the situation in his own country and asked them that why should we believe you when you're not accountable to your own people? Not a single one of them asked him about the issues you're bringing up, like a country that condones stoning people to death. How can it talk of human rights? Never mind what he says about Holocaust. Even on that issue, they have been, very lenient. It seems as if he amuses them more than anything else. But the fact is that you cannot judge a country just by its government, not even in this country. In this country, the majority of people are against the war. We cannot say that everything that President Bush says represents the people in this country. And yet, Mr. Ahmadinejad and every action and every word is given so much publicity and very little is said of the rest of us.
I wanted to get you to. There was a wave of liberalization in about 97. Is that right? When we had a different president in Iran, what is driving the return to religious orthodoxy?
Well, these waves of liberalization have been occurring almost every few years. They happened also in 1980s, right after the Iraq War, with Mr. Rafsanjani. Part of it is because the society itself, Mr. Ahmadinejad made a very interesting comment when he said that the universities for the past 150 years have been secular and liberal, and we have failed to purge them of liberalism and secularism.
Okay, let me interrupt just because we're coming right up on a break and we're going to get right back to our conversation talking about changes in Iran. We'll be right back.
Penn supports WHYY. Are you sad all the time? Lost interest in things you used to enjoy? Have you ever been diagnosed with depression? If so, you may be eligible to participate in a recurrent depression research study at Penn at 215-573-8582. The study is run by Penn doctors, and you may receive study-related medication and medical evaluations at no cost. 215-573-8582. 215-573-8582.
I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, it's Composting 101. We'll explain the easy, no-mess way to make the world's finest soil-improving, disease-fighting plant food, and how to correctly recycle kitchen scraps and other green waste, plus chemical-free answers to all your garden questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY 91 FM.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Ingrid Mattson, the recently elected president of the Islamic Society of North America, the largest Muslim organization on the continent. She's the first woman, the first convert, and the first native North American elected to the position. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
And welcome back to Radio Times. Our topic today is the return to religious orthodoxy in Iran and new moves by the government there to impose restrictions on the social, political, and intellectual life of the country. Our guest for the hour, Azar Nafisi. She is a former professor in Iran who fled the country in the 1990s. She is the author of the best-selling memoir, Reading Lolita in Tehran. Well, when we just broke off, Azar Nafisi, you were explaining these waves of liberalization and what might be driving the current situation.
Yeah, I think part of it is the history of Iran itself. As Mr. Ahmadinejad confessed, you have 150 years of secularization and liberalization in the country, and it can't just be wiped out by 30 years of theocratic rule. And the society itself doesn't need to go to West to see the importance of liberalization and secularization. All it has to do is to go back to its own history. After all, the most popular leader in Iran still now was the nationalist Prime Minister Mossadegh. So Iranians have that history to go back to, and they want to very much to be part of the world, and they're constantly being resisted by the Islamic regime, and repression does not do away with people's desire to lead a better life. So we keep going through these periods of liberalization and then followed by repression, because liberalization immediately makes people want more freedoms. They don't say, okay, this is enough. We don't want to go any further. And the more freedoms they want, the more dangerous they become.
I want to get our phone number again. The number to call if you would like to join the conversation with Azar Nafisi is 1-888-477-9499. We do have a few lines open. The number 1-888-477-WHYY. Well, as you say, there is this tradition of liberalism and secularism and modernity in Iran. And what is driving the current? Is it mullahs? Is it Ahmadinejad himself? Is it student leaders?
Well, part of the danger that Mr. Ahmadinejad feels, and by the way, his mentor within the clerics, Misbah-e Yazdi, is a very marginal character who is not looked upon by many within not just the Iranian society, but within the clerics themselves. And he has been criticized by both religious leaders as well as more liberal religious scholars such as Abdul Karim Suroush. What scares them is not just the secular and liberal elements within the society. It is the fact that from within the clerical establishment and from within the regime itself, more and more people are becoming liberal and secular. The best example is Akbar Ganji, the dissident journalist who is right now currently in the United States. And he was one of the most ardent and virulent Islamists at the beginning of the revolution, and people like him from within are defecting, and that is what makes it very dangerous to the regime, and that is why they want to give a lesson to the rest of the society.
I guess one thing that a lot of us don't understand, I know that there is a constitution and there are elections in Iran. I think among people's most enduring images of Iran, of course, are from the 1979 hostage crisis.
Yes.
When there was a sense that the country was seized by a fanatical and decidedly undemocratic band of clerics. Does the government, is it accountable in any way? Did the election which brought us Mr. Ahmadinejad, was it a real expression of the popular will?
Well, you know, one of the things that I always tell my American friends about elections in Iran, if you imagine that they tell you that this is a Christian majority country and you can only vote because you know that the Council of Guardians and the leader can boycott anyone, any of the candidates at any point. So they tell you
Say that again.
Both the leader, the supreme leader, and a council of guardians, which is a council of mainly conservative clerics, they sort of purge the candidates. They are the ones who have the last say in who can be candidate for both presidential elections and the parliamentary elections. So it is so much, it's like saying that you are free to choose from three different Baptist ministers.
Right.
You know, which one would you choose? So within that limitation, you have the freedom to vote. But in case of Mr. Ahmadinejad, I just would like to remind you that two of the candidates, the former President Rafsanjani and the former Speaker of the House, Karoubi, they both protested the rigging of the elections. And the fact that quite a sizable part of the population boycotted the elections.
So in effect, I mean, the clerical structure decides who is qualified to run and therefore control things. You know, I was looking back at some of the reviews when your book Reading Lolita in Tehran was published, and there was a point where you write that when you were in Iran in the late 70s and early 80s, and if I believe this is from the book, the laws had regressed to where they had been before before your grandmother's time. The age of marriage was lowered to 9. Adultery and prostitution could be punished by stoning to death. Women under law were considered to have half the worth of men. Are those conditions returning again?
Well, those conditions are laws. So you see, during the time of liberalization, like during the time of Mr. Khatami's reign, there was a horrible term used for stoning. They were saying that there's a moratorium on stoning. meanwhile, some people were stoned even then. So because of the effort of women like Shirin Ebadi and many others in Iran, they changed the age of marriage from 9 to 13, but still the presiding religious judge can decide if a girl can be married, before 13. But before the revolution, the age of marriage was 18. We had women ministers. We had a woman minister for women's affairs. Women like Shirin Ebadi, the Nobel laureate, was a judge. So that is why I'm saying that the past comes to haunt the present.
Your mother served in Parliament, didn't she?
My mother served in Parliament, and, you know, I'm just about my mother. Till the day she died, she considered herself a faithful Muslim. She went on pilgrimage to Mecca, but she never wore the veil. And my grandmother always wore the veil. Who is to say which one of them was more Muslim? And my own grandmother was very, very depressed during the time of the revolution. She kept telling us, this is not Islam, because the veil now has become a symbol of the state and not a symbol of religion. And this is something people don't understand, that many religious people in my country feel that their religion has been confiscated. Mm-hmm. And many of the grand ayatollahs at the time of the revolution objected to theocracy, and they were jailed and defrocked, and some were killed.
We're talking about religious changes in Iran with Azar Nafisi. She is the author of her best-selling memoir, Reading Lolita in Tehran. The number to call if you'd like to talk to her and join the conversation, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Just staying on conditions for women for a moment, are people in Iran and Tehran now routinely required to wear the veil? I mean, are there people who will... What happens if they don't?
Everyone is required to wear the veil.
And what happens if they don't?
Whether you're Christian or atheist or Muslim. What had happened, especially since 97, was that the rules had become very lax. The religious squads were removed from the streets, And women wore their veil in the most outrageous way possible. Short covers, the scarves were colorful, they wore makeup. So the streets, the face of the streets had changed. And of course, that also gives the lie to the regime's claim that this is the way women want to wear the veil of their own volition. If they did, then you don't need to bring back the squads into the streets.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. But tell us who exactly enforces this. I mean, on a practical way, how does this...
Well, there are so many different branches of authority. We have the revolutionary committees that are supposed to be sort of the guardians of morality in the cities, like if you have parties with drinking or music. Then we have the militia, the revolutionary militia, who also have the authority to stop you in the streets. And then before we had these morality squads, that were part of the revolutionary committees who would...
So are these religious students? Are they civil servants? Are they cops? Who are they?
Well, they are employed by the government. They do not have to be... I guess that their most important credential is to be faithful to the revolution and to the government.
So they are sent out on patrol, in effect?
They were sent out. When I was in Iran, they still had them. And after 97, they sort of, for all practical purposes, were not visible the way they used to be. They would drive this patrol the streets in white Nissan patrols with two armed men and two armed women. And they would stop women whom they thought were not dressed properly or young people holding hands, and they could take them to revolutionary committees. And officially, if you don't wear the veil properly, you can be flogged up to 76 lashes plus fines. Now, all of these laws under Mr. Khatami had relaxed. And so what I guess is happening now is that Mr. Ahmadinejad is trying to pick them up one by one.
And do you understand why that is? I mean, some have speculated that he wants to distract people from promises he made for economic, improvements, et cetera.
Well, that is partly it. That is partly it that he wants to divert attention from the failures. But also, we have to remember that the whole constitution and the laws that this system believes in are based on these. And if you relax everything, then you are relaxing your authority. A lot of people feel that the only way you can control the population and impose your authority is sort of going by the letter of the law. Mm-hmm. And that is why Shirin Ebadi, in some of her talks, would mention that what she is doing, which is fundamental, is in fact questioning those laws,
We've got a caller who wants to join the conversation. Dorian is waiting from South Philly. Are you there, Dorian?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, hi, go ahead.
I was just wondering, I've been doing some research on women in mainly Muslim countries who either are forced to veil or are not, and I've found some evidence that there's been cases where women feel more comfortable wearing it simply because they feel it protects them from sexual harassment on the street. And I was just wondering if that is the case for some people, for some women in Iran, they honestly feel safer wearing it, even though it is forced and shouldn't be.
Well, some might claim that. Of course, it has never, ever, I have many writings from my students and I've had experience it myself. Definitely it has not prevented anyone from being sexually harassed. If anything, people become much greedier in harassing you. But the point that I want to make is that I think that women should be left to wear the veil if they feel that it's an expression of their religion or if they feel more comfortable. That is not the question. And sometimes it becomes confused. The question is that women should have a choice. that those women who take up the veil, they take it voluntarily, and they're expressing something with it. But when you force everyone, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, seculars, wearing the veil, you take away the right of the traditional Muslim women by making a statement about their faith and their beliefs. The question we're dealing with is the question of freedom of choice, and it is not the other question. Otherwise, I think any woman who feels more comfortable should wear the veil.
Thank you for calling, Dorian. And
Thank you.
And we do have some lines open if you want to join the conversation with Azar Nafisi. The number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Have you had experiences yourself with the morality police?
Yes, I have, but you know, it's very common. There was a joke in Iran saying that you know, it's very trendy to be questioned by the police. If you're not, there must be something wrong with you.
You just described people, armed men in cars that can take you away and subject you to a flogging. That doesn't sound funny to me.
No, it doesn't. But it is like Eastern Europe. If you have to live within such extremes and within such absurd extremes, then one way of surviving is to look at yourself with a sense of humor. And that was how many of us, including myself, survived. It wasn't funny, the fact that my student would be penalized because she was running up the stairs because she was late for class. It wasn't funny when
running was an offense.
They said that when a woman runs, she attracts attention to herself. You see, women, the whole purpose of the veil was for women to become invisible, to not attract attention. But when you had it within the traditional societies 200 years ago, women were staying at home. And the only time they would go out would be to visit relatives or friends. Some might do some shopping for home, but women were essentially at home. Now, in a society like Iran, where you have amazingly vibrant working women who are visible everywhere, to tell them that they at the same time need to be invisible by wearing the veil creates a paradox. It creates situations that are absolutely absurd. Once I was stopped, although I was wearing, in fact, that day I was very good, and I had been wearing a black outfit from head to foot, and the guy told me that the last button on my robe was open. Now, he's not supposed to look at me. And he noticed that last button,
Right. So you buttoned it and went on your way? Or you scolded him for leering at you?
I usually got into fights, but some paid heavily for getting into those fights.
There was a case in June of a woman, and I won't try to pronounce her name, a 34-year-old mother of two convicted of adultery, who was sentenced to death by stoning. Now, the sentence has not been carried out. Is that right?
No, it hasn't been. As far as I know, it has been pending. But I think it is cases. It is more than Mr. Ahmadinejad. It's cases like this that should be given voice to.
Have stoning deaths occurred in recent years?
They had occurred. I had the numbers. I had them here. They occurred also during Mr. Khatami's time. Yes. Yes.
And you've talked about how so many people in Iran, crave for a more rational, secular society. Do they watch these stonings? I mean, these are very public events, right?
I have to say that most people don't. I remember that when I was in Iran, this was in, I think, early 90s, in a town by Caspian. They were calling on people to come and watch. And my friend, who's a teacher there, elementary school teacher there, she was calling me crying and saying that some people went, but most people don't.
But the stoning did occur. Yeah.
But stoning did occur.
Okay.
And then they also killed, I think they hanged.
We're up on a break, and we'll get right back to our conversation. This is Radio Times.
Supporting WHYY, Pennsylvania Ballet presents a tribute to Jerome Robbins, October 11th through the 15th at the Academy of Music. Romance and Revelry features Fancy Free, a ballet that displays the escapades of three sailors on shore leave set to the music of Leonard Bernstein, plus the return of the concert and more. Romance and Revelry, October 11th through the 15th at the Academy of Music. For tickets, Ticket Philadelphia at 215-893-1999 or paballet.org.
Next time on Day to Day.
Who's that walking around here?
Fats Waller was a far better pianist than most people knew.
He was a brilliant entertainer, and sometimes the wonderful musicality of what he was doing kind of got lost.
Now a new CD collection tracks his incredible legacy.
Remembering Fats Waller next time on Day to Day.
Be sure it's true when you say I love you.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
A lie, what I say.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A new session of the Supreme Court opens next week. We'll look at a few of the items on the agenda. Also, a trip to China inspires alto sax man Kenny Garrett. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now. Today at noon on WHYY.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Dave Davies in for Marty Moskowin. Continue our conversation with Azar Nafisi. She is the author of Reading Lolita in Tehran, a former professor in Iran who left in part because of religious restrictions, which appear to be returning to all spheres of Iranian life. The number to call if you want to give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Well, Azar Nafisi, before we left, I know we were talking about some of the restrictions that the government has imposed. And let me ask sort of an open but maybe a slightly off question. You know, a lot of Americans say we can't affect what, you know, sovereign governments do within their borders. I mean, Saudi Arabia imposes lots of restrictions. Why should Americans care about what's happening in Iran right now?
You know, it is very strange, and maybe a more extreme case, but some people were saying the same thing in 1930s in regards to Nazi Germany. People were saying that in regards to Stalin's crimes. The easiest answer is out of compassion, but I think more pragmatically, Americans by now should understand that what happens in other parts of the world directly and indirectly affects them. And what happens in other parts of the world has some relation to them in terms of the fact that they're also implicated. Saudi Arabia has been America's biggest ally for many, many years now. And America has been supporting Saudi Arabia. So it is not as if what happens to Saudis is only Saudis' business, although I do not at any moment propagate the idea that we should intervene in anyone's affairs. But American people, democratic organizations and groups can definitely, add voice to Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch because it affects them. During the time of anti-slavery movement, half a million British women signed petitions and sent money to the anti-slavery fighters in this country. Should we have said that they should not have done that? And should we have not said that slavery in America did not affect what happened in Britain? I think that after especially 9/11, we should have learned that lesson.
And there's a connection, I guess, between the repression inside Iran and an aggressive international policy on a lot of issues, right?
Oh, definitely. And Americans should know that if a government, be it Saudi or Iranian, is not accountable to its own people, does not accept the rules and laws that are humane, it will not be accountable to them. Iran is a supporter of terror around the world, you know. What happens in Iran, whether democratic forces are there or non-democratic forces, has an effect on them. But at the same time, I would definitely condemn an intervention like what happened in Iraq.
I want to get to some of our callers in just a minute, but I wanted to throw one idea at you. There was a piece in Newsweek recently where, you know, a writer, Fareed Zakaria,
yeah,
I believe, said, you know, these things are are very troubling, but that what should happen is that President Bush should offer to reopen the embassy in Tehran, begin student exchanges, in effect feed the interest of young Iranians in contact with the Western world. What do you think?
Well, I think that Fareed Zakaria's suggestion is a very interesting one, and as he mentions, you should be creative in relation to Iran. Dialogue should be based on firm principles, and I don't think that the Iranian regime would ever think that opening the U.S. embassy in Tehran is to its advantage. For one thing, there would be long lines for people wanting to apply, and I think that it is good policy. And it is the correct policy. And I do think that the American government, but mainly American people, should reach out to Iranian people and to not identify the people with their regimes. I think that is the main mistake.
Yeah, how does that happen? I mean, how do those person-to-person contacts, how does that get facilitated?
Well, when one thing is to try to, first of all, you know, there are so many books now, and you can also go on the internet, that come from within the Iranian culture, that tell you what that culture is all about. They're either memoirs or works of fiction or poems, even Iran's classical poetry, where 700 years ago, Hafez would criticize the hypocritical clerics who flog people in public and drink wine in private. You know, it's a very sensual, joyous form of poetry that is against what is going on now. It was against it 700 years ago. So I think American people need to educate themselves.
Okay, let's get to a couple of callers. Mohammed is waiting from Philadelphia there. Mohammed?
Yes.
Hi, go right ahead.
Okay. I wanted to ask Dr. Nafisi about an issue that she hasn't addressed in her book, or I don't think in any of her talks that I've heard, and that's the relationship between the American foreign policy in the 1950s, 1953 especially, when they dismantled a working democracy in Iran and reinstalled a dictatorial power in the form of Shah's government. And how that whole thing led to the rising fundamentalism that we see. I mean, it is one thing to criticize what's happening now, but then not looking at it, the root causes of it, which is, in Iran's case, is dismantling of the working democracy in Iran, and also Americans' current support for other dictators in the region, including Saudi Arabia, including, you know, a lot of repressive governments in the region. And I'm wondering why she refuses to address that question.
Good point, Mohammed. I'm going to go to you 1 second, Azhar Nafisi. When I was in college in the 70s, streets in Austin, Texas, were full of Iranian students angry about American support for the Shah. Yeah, it's an interesting piece of history. Go ahead.
Actually, I don't know where Mr. Mohammed got the idea that I have been refusing to say that. I was just saying it, actually, in response to you, that America has been supporting repressive regimes like Saudi Arabia. And I have mentioned it time and time again in an article in New Republic, as I remember, as among others, that America's support of those people that it calls its allies but who are non-democratic is wrong. It has been wrong in relation to Iran, in relation to Saudi Arabia, in relation to Egypt, and it is wrong when it goes to Afghanistan and allies itself with Mujahideen against Taliban. So okay, we have the problem right now in Afghanistan. And it was wrong in Iraq. And that is why American people should understand what happens in Iran or Saudi Arabia in fact does affect their lives.
You know, but I appreciate you, Mohammed, just raising the issue, apart from whether he may have misread some of your thoughts in the past. Connect some of the cultural dots here for us. I mean, you have the United States intervening to remove, I guess it was the Mossadegh regime.
Yes,
in the 50s,
and
how did that lead to the growth of Islamic radicalism and some of the move away from the cultural secularism, which you said was so strong in Iran?
Actually, the Islamic radicalism, to mention one point, after removal of Mossadegh and during the time of Mossadegh in Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini's mentor, Ayatollah Kashani, took sides with U.S., and it took sides with Mr. Zahedi, who became prime minister after Mr. Mossadegh. So the Islamists now in Iran saying that U.S. should apologize to us. Mossadegh has been one of the worst. They hate him more in many ways than they hate the Shah. And they have been killing and intimidating and torturing his followers in Iran. So if America should do any apologizing, it's to the Iranian people and not to these people. But I think the rise of Islamism in Iran came out of political dictatorship within the country, in a country where you had democratic institutions, but you did not have the freedom to speak politically, the freedom to have different political parties. And one mistake that the Shah made was to turn Ayatollah Khomeini into a martyr figure by banning his books, banning discussion of his thought in Iran, and it created a hard core around him. To say very, very shortly, also at that time in Iran, the political dictatorship led to the creation of very radical leftist groups who aligned themselves with the Islamists. And in the region, if you remember, U.S. was creating a green belt against Soviet Union,
right.
Pakistani Zia-ul-Haq, the Taliban, actually, and many Islamists who then turned against liberal democracies after the fight with Soviet Union ended.
You know, and just to one more little piece of history to connect to current events, the current Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, was believed to have had some role, I believe, in those who invaded the American embassy in 79 during the revolution. Is that right?
Well, it has been said of him. I mean, Mr. Ahmadinejad he has not had any significant official positions in Iran, but he has been working both in terms of the with the people who took the Americans hostages, and he has been very active in repression. Also, people claim it needs to be substantiated more, and that he was active in also interrogation of political prisoners as well.
Hmm. Let's go to Patrick. He is with us from Dover. Are you there, Patrick?
Yes.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah. I really am enjoying your show, and I was wondering if the two of you could comment on. It seems like our current administration in the United States is involved in two struggles. One is fighting fanaticism overseas, at the same time trying to bring about more religion in our own government. Seems like a great irony, and maybe that's one reason to pay attention to what's going on over there.
Huh, interesting.
I just wanted you to comment on that.
Interesting thought. Do you see a parallel between the move towards religious fundamentalism in the States and what we see in Iran?
Well, you know, I keep reminding my friends that neither democracy and freedom nor religious fundamentalism and terror are geographically or culturally determined. They can happen everywhere. And definitely we do have, a basis for the growth of fundamentalism in this country, and people should be aware of it. I think the main difference between Iran and United States is democracy. As long as people in this country are aware of it and are aware of fragility of the values they cherish so much, and as long as there is multivocality, then fundamentalists could remain in minority, where I think they do belong. In my country, they have the power. And so there is not that multivocality. I think Mr. Ahmadinejad or Mr. Khamenei in a democratic Iran should have their voices, but should not rule. You know, so that is the difference. But I do see that in this country as well, there are seeds that could be turned into serious problems.
You know, Azar Nafisi, our producer Susan Greenbaum reminds me that you have been called by some a neoconservative. where does this appellation come from?
For example, Shirin Ebadi has been called an agent of Iranian regime. Akbar Ganji has been called both an American agent and an Iranian agent. You go by people's positions. From the very beginning, before the war in Iraq started, when there was discussions of it, I was against that war. I have always been for. I'm not a political figure, and I have always been for democratic change from within Iran, a non-violent change, which, as I mentioned right now, would even give Mr. Ahmadinejad his due. In what way am I a neoconservative? I don't know, you know. And what I say now, I have been saying for the past 30 years of my life. This is nothing new. I wrote about Nabokov when I was in Iran. I wrote Reading Lolita in Tehran when I came here. I was fighting for women's rights in Iran. I'm fighting for them in here. I think we should. It is infantile and slanderous to define people through guilt by association rather than their ideas.
Does U.S. support for Democrats and secular forces in Iran actually undermine their effectiveness?
I mean, it depends upon the kind of support. I think that if U.S. support would mean being firm on giving voice in the United Nations or whenever they enter into negotiations with the Iranian government about the rights of the Iranian people, and if they acknowledge those rights and if they don't compromise those rights, it is good. But I have never thought that going behind one group against the other, or one individual, I've never thought it a good thing, and I don't think it a good thing now. I think U.S. Help give voice to Iranian people through maybe broadcasts explaining what the U.S. position is, specifically going behind any groups, I do not see that.
Azar Nafis, we have just about a minute left, and I wonder if you can conclude by giving us your sense of prospects for progressive change in Iran. I mean, what will make a difference and insurrection, continued agitation for democracy?
Well, I think that definitely the change from Iran will come from Iran's civil society, and I think especially the youth have a hand in it, and I think that it is inevitable that there will be change, because you cannot. I mean, a government that only uses force is vulnerable. We don't see the vulnerability of people who take up the guns, and the only way we can resist these guns is through choosing another domain. I always think of Mandela in South Africa, or Gandhi in India, or Lech Walesa, or Havel in Eastern Europe. I think that that is the kind of change we need. We need to change minds and not the regimes only.
Well, thank you so much. Azar Nafisi is the author of Reading Lolita in Tehran. She is currently working on two books, one about the lives of women in Iran at the end of the 19th century and another on the power of imagination. Azar Nafisi, thanks so much for spending the hour with us.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Our engineers today were Scott Williams and Al Banks. Devorah Lissick, Alan Tu, and Susan Greenbaum are producers of Radio Times. Thanks, as always, to our caller. Sorry if you didn't get on. Drop us an email. The address is radiotimes@whyy.org. Thanks so much for joining us. For Marty Moskowain, I'm Dave Davies. You're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.